Is Lead Stories. I'm Nutrice Lead. It is Friday, the 25th of January. Just like that. I mean, I can't get over it that it's already the 25th of January. My goodness, how the time flies. That is a string quartet of Soweto with Wimboe, a song I think you are quite familiar with if you're, well, of a certain age. I'm 22 myself. I don't know about you, but it's a familiar song to me. A lot has happened this week, and we didn't get a chance to talk about a lot of things. So today, I'm calling it Open Forum, Free Forum Friday. You tell me what you think is significant. You can call me at 1-888-874-4888 and restart that conversation. But, of course, we saw the first round of talks yesterday, confirmation talks with Senator Kerry, the successor of Hillary Rodham Clinton at the Department of State, or the putative successor. We have to say all these correct words until the Senate officially gives its green light. But, you know, it's a very interesting thing when you think about it. And, you know, you have to appreciate the irony of things in situations like this. Here is everybody pretending that it's not so unusual, that they're going through the process and, you know, the process is being observed. It's all about the process. Well, the process involved the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, whose task it is to select the nominee, being presented to the very committee that he heads. The very committee that he heads, by the former, soon-to-be former Secretary of State, who had just been before the committee. It's all palsy-walsy. Everything is going just fine. He got a little turbulence, just a little, from Rand Paul. But other than that, it was going very smoothly, as it ought to go, because, I mean, it's a club. Club members interviewing a club member of whom they think quite highly. But something else is interesting. I mean, this is it casts a certain light on President Obama. The Senate of course, is a millionaire, is a multimillionaire club. And Kerry is no exception. Kerry is a very, very wealthy man. And you wonder, after a while, what American politics is shaping up to be when the people making decisions about how this country is going to be run, not only in terms of domestic policy, how the United States essentially becomes a major player in the world. It's a whole new ballgame here in politics. And I wondered whether you sense that this shift that has definitively occurred. It's really amazing to observe that. I mean, I remember politics being about, you know, people scrapping over public policy and power and all that. But it's a different ballgame in a way today, because there's so much money associated with politics today all over the world. And in a sense, many of the countries that we are dealing with have patterned their own approaches to politics based on what they have gleaned from the American system of politics. So in that sense, we're entering a globalization of a different order. The globalization that we're talking about today is a combination of raw power and incredible amounts of money. And the exclusive club becoming smaller and smaller, and the concentration of money power also getting smaller and smaller. But it's like we're watching this, the unfolding of a surreal existence where the vast majority of people on this planet have very little, if any, say in the aggregation of this power and the money and the combination of both, and are yet immediately affected by the decisions made by this power elite. It is a really startling thing to observe. And the mentality. I mean, when you watch Hillary Clinton and her very demeanor in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and in the House as well, there was a certain attitude that informed her behavior. And it increasingly is, you see it in many different ways. I mean, hers was a little bit accentuated, but the idea that people have come to the realization that they occupy these places of privilege and are beyond the scope of accountability. They may be accountable to each other to some degree, but once you're admitted to the club, you therefore carry yourself in such a way that, hey, you know, I'm now beyond local leader, I'm beyond regional leader, I am now part of the global leadership. And when it comes to the level of global leadership, I am part of that elite group. This is a fascinating thing to see. And so her attitude was to the Senate, to whom she is absolutely accountable, the attitude was, I don't have to answer to you. I'm here really ceremonially, but I'm aware, you know, you get the sense of the awareness of it. I am aware of the fact that my power actually exceeds any power you think you have, because I am on the global scene. You guys are just dealing with U.S. stuff. I'm global, baby. I'm beyond you now. And we see that attitude spilling over into the small membership of the super elite club. And to my mind, it wasn't like this. I mean, if it really, in fact, was like this, it was kind of kept quiet a little bit. You contained that kind of raw ambition. You found it to be really bad manners to allow yourself to exhibit this kind of behavior in public. You just did not do that. You contained it. Now they don't care. Heads of state are behaving like absolute renegades because they too have plugged into this global power and believe themselves to be at an even higher level of untouchability than they were before. And it goes from the smallest of countries to the largest of countries. As long as there is a sense that we are playing on the global scene, the attitude prevails. And since corporations are people, we see that behavior there too. So it's a very interesting thing, don't you think, that the corporations are behaving exactly like the people, both given license in the sense of the corporations, given license by the courts, to behave like people. And so they are behaving like people. All these banksters that we are seeing and the renegade behaviors that they are engaging in an attitude that says, you can't touch us. It's not that we are too big to fail. It is that we are too big to be accountable to you. We have our own government. We have our own way of operating, and it requires you to make the adjustment. Get hip to that, you know? We can do as we please. The Barack Obama of today, entering now, he's in his second term, excuse me, the Barack Obama of today is attitudinally very different from the Barack Obama of just 4 years ago. And I contend it is because he has embraced the reality of his ability to play at the global level, the global power. And he has shown certain signs that are very discomforting. With all the talk, very smooth, that he's talking about all these things that people want to hear. He's a righteous and just man. He is filled with compassion for, he can't quite say the word. I'm still trying to see just how many times, get a clicker and click every time that Barack Obama would say the word poor or poverty. He stops just in the middle class. That's as low as he's willing to go. But his policies are really of great concern because they are diametrically opposed to his professed leanings. His professed leanings one could categorize as progressive, as liberal, for lack of a better term, and I'm using it in the sense that most people understand it. But when we look at the practical application and when we look at the reality of the people being plugged in, you see that they share that consciousness of a higher level of power that they embrace, that they understand, that they understand themselves to have. And as he shapes his cabinet, you'd see the like-mindedness of the individuals chosen. These are people who are ready, and in some cases just yearning, Kerry is one of them, to be legitimized at level. Send me global. Make me global. I am elected by the American people. but my aspirations are global. I want more power. I want to make more money. We got the shift of Barack Obama with the creation of this shadow government, and in this regard, again, he is following the pattern set by Bill Clinton, where he transforms his machine, the machine that brought him political victory, Obama for America, he transforms it into a lobbying group, as if nobody knows that it is a lobbying group. Obama for America, that well-oiled behemoth of a machine that plugged into people at the very local level, delivered Barack Obama beyond local, beyond regional, beyond national power to international power. And he understands it very well. He is now in his second term. In his first term, I guess, he was trying to get used to the idea. In his second term, he is fully aware of his idea, of the idea that he has, in fact, been launched at the level of global power, which is the unprecedented position for a person of color in the United States. Never before have we had that. And we see his attitude now. I remember when he first got into office, and you would watch the almost a hint of discomfort as he had to salute to the soldiers who would stand at the ready as he got out of his helicopter or his plane. Because the idea of him being, you know, in the military or having military mannerisms and all that, but now he understands that he is commander-in-chief. His attitude is different. He's adjusting to that level of power psychologically. And as he makes that adjustment in his own mind, we have to pay attention because he's likely now to do things differently. And we have to buckle up because it's a whole different mindset that we're dealing with here now. He had hidden his sense of, how should I say it? He just wasn't ready psychologically. Conceptually, he might have been, but psychologically, he wasn't really ready for this. I mean, this thing was amazing to take a guy from literally nowhere, and within a decade, he's president of the United States. This is unprecedented. This is skyrocketing to power. But within himself, you could adjust to that kind of power when you're elected to the city or local dog catcher, and then they promote you to local cat catcher and so forth. And your mind adjusts with the gradual uplift. When you get to this circle in meteoric fashion, you have a meteoric rise. You're not well initiated into the circle. And even for people who are initiated into the circle, the fact is that they keep the membership really low. But I used to watch his body language as he would disembark from the plane or the helicopter and make that, salute. And you could see a glimmer of, my God, I'm not into this kind of thing. I ain't into saluting and all that, but all right, I'll do it because people are watching. But now he's a different person. And it is leading to the same place where Clinton was and still is, which is power and money. power and money, or conversely, money and power. They can take it in any order, as long as these two dynamics exist. When Charles Rangel, at the time fourth most powerful member of Congress, sitting as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, but from Harlem, Black Harlem, the people's Harlem, Adam Clayton Powell's Harlem. When that Charlie Rangel says publicly he's embarrassed by Barack Obama's essentially choices in the team he's picking to go with him this time, that it was commented loudly, this man seems not to be able to find too many people in his part of the hood to take some of these jobs and to take control at this level. He's already cherry picking which other people of color he will bring into the circle because he likes the idea that he's part of the exclusive membership. And if you read Frantz Fanon, you would understand the psychological adjustment that this president has been making. Raised by a European-American mother, Barack Obama's psychological orientation is to life as a kind of anomaly. He's a black-skinned white man. In that sense, that's his acculturation. He has been raised that way. So he's very comfortable in the white world. He's very comfortable there. And throughout his sojourn, he has been able to successfully balance this anomaly because in the United States, in the broadest sense that we're talking about, black people do not enjoy these privileges. Certainly, they don't enjoy power at all at this level. Never have. So there isn't very much mileage there to examine and to cull from and to adopt. So he is expressing in this second term that he is comfortable with a culture that the black community as a whole is not comfortable with. He trusts a culture that the black world does not trust. He's familiar with this culture that the black world is familiar with, but not in a healthy and positive way. They are familiar with this culture as more often than not victims of it, not members of it. So what does this mean with respect to his leadership? We have already seen the devolution of his authority to other people. I mean, anybody, Hillary Clinton, and I'm not trying to engage in Clinton bashing here, but we have to be factual. Hillary Clinton, the Hillary Clinton that we saw, was a tamed down version of the Hillary Clinton that is said to exist when the lights of the warmth of the cameras is gone. I mean, she's been known legendarily as a very caustic woman, but the Clintons have that magic. They can afford it because they've mastered the art of being one thing and saying another. But it was really remarkable, given the vitriol that existed in the first run, that Hillary Clinton would be the one he would select to be the nation's top diplomat. And of course, we know he didn't select her. He was informed that he will be selecting her and agreed. As the new initiate of power at this level, this is what accounts for the departure of so many people from the cabinet. I think they were responding in the first term to the Barack Obama who was saying certain things. They shared that point of view, what he said, and over the last 4 years got to know what he is from a psychological point of view. And there was dissonance there. The Barack Obama who was saying one thing was doing another. I think they signed on to the Barack Obama who was saying good things. They had what he said the nation ought to have and what he said he was, which was the harbinger of hope. But of course, he's a new initiate in this circle of power, and he understands it, and he wants it, and he's okay with it. So we see the pattern now, and it's very clear. It's exactly, I mean, there's nothing really very new, except that there's a special study that we have to undertake, the psychological part, to the extent that we can. We're not professional psychologists and psychoanalysts, but I think we are smart enough to put two and two together and come up with four. Barack Obama devolves Obama for America into organizing for America. This machine once again has been transmuted into his own personal vehicle to accomplish certain things. Bill Clinton formed the Clinton Global Initiative, which is a parallel government. He formed it in such a way as to capitalize on the connections, the direct connections that he had with ongoing government since he left, even with Republican administrations. It's like France. Everybody knows who runs France. It's not the guy at the top. It's the bureaucrats who run France. So they don't care who changes, what new party is in. You pay attention to the bureaucrats. They're the ones running the machine. Clinton had left the White House. He was gone, but his connections to the White House remained. And so Barack Obama patterns himself after that. Clinton has formed his pathway to glory, which is this entity that will now connect the power he has amassed and the power that he has connections with, and two, he will now amass it into a personal fortune, because it will serve his afterlife, and B, he will now begin the process of forcing legislation through to passage by exerting power at the outside to get things done on the inside. Because with the admission to this level of global power, it is also hypnotic, it's also addictive. You have to keep it going, and that is why Obama for America has become organizing for America. This machine to deliver the vote by the people of America, to engage the grassroots in what arguably could be said to be a symbolic exercise of democracy, because all they want is critical mass. All they want is the ability to count hundreds of thousands and millions of votes over something. The pretense of organizing the people for power, that now becomes organizing the people to give me what I want, the power that I want. There is no compact here. There is no quid pro quo. There is no rate of return. Having proven that I can organize, that is what power is the people organized. I will now take this concept to another level and organize the people in order to achieve my personal agendas. And that's what it is. Bill Clinton did it spectacularly well. So this is a different Barack Obama, who is in his second term. And still people are believing that here's a really, you know, down-to-earth good guy. I mean, his wife has bangs. I mean, how bad could that be? I mean, that isn't that really democratic? And his children wear J. Crew. I mean, come on now. That's American, isn't it? It's a real American. But they need to pay attention to the shift in Barack Obama, the psychological shift in Barack Obama. Just as an aside, with regard to Barack Obama's father, who continues to be portrayed in the public eye by none other than the president as a less than stellar example of fatherhood, which is why he now goes to the exact opposite behaviors publicly and privately to convey to the people there's no question that he is a devoted father. What often is not said, in fact, I've never heard it really said, is that Barack Obama's father was about the first wave of Africans and people from the colonized world to be shipped abroad, essentially, or shipped wherever they could be shipped to acquire specialized knowledge and expertise by their respective nations, who were engaged sometimes militarily and otherwise in other ways of negotiation with their former colonizers for independence. This happened in Africa, it happened in the Caribbean, where young people with potential for leadership were identified and were recruited as the first wave of new leaders that would form the cadre, the first working cadre of nation building. This is very serious stuff. It's dismissed as a kind of guy who just didn't want the responsibilities of parenthood or husbandhood, but you have to take this into consideration. So Barack Obama's father came to the United States with the mindset of many Africans who were allowed the privilege of leaving the country and being supported by their respective governments that were in bitter armed struggle for independence, as Kenya was. They sent those, there were people who took on the task, we are going to fight, you are going to learn. And when we call you, you will come back home. When we call you, you will come back home and help us build this nation. We need your skills. That is why we spare you from the ugliness of war. And we send you to expand your brain. And when the call came to come back home to Kenya, and help us build a nation, there appeared to be some resistance within the marriage to that idea, because it involved a hard life where the privileges of skin color were no longer relevant, where the conveniences were simply non-existent, you know, no microwave, no side-by-side refrigerators. And for some people, that would have been a very bad choice. In post-colonial world where it's all turmoil. So I just urge you to keep that in mind when certain things are said about, you know, black men abandoning their families. And the flip side of that coin was, here was a man responding to his country's call to assist in nation building. And it was his decision that he would assist his nation in building, reconstructing itself after hundreds of years of British occupation. All right, I've thrown out enough. 888-874-4888. Let's hear what you're thinking about. Everything is on the table today, and I'm waiting for your call. Right after this message, we'll take them. Away with the Soweto String Quartet. I tell you, we could really do fantastic things with our cultures, our various cultures. This is Yatrice Lead, and you're listening to Lead Stories right here on VRN.FM. So what are your thoughts today? Having survived the week and observed myriad developments out there, political, economic, social, you tell me what's on your mind today. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I just want to ask again, I received an email from a veteran, if you're listening today, a Vietnam veteran, from Oregon. And I was about to read it, and I don't know what I did, but it just vanished from my screen, and I can't find it anymore. I don't know where it went. I went hunting for it. I don't know where it went. So if you are that person who sent me that email that I was about to read and really just soak up, please do send it to me again. I just did not get a chance to read it, and I really feel deprived because I wanted to get the substance of what it is you were saying. So this is a special shout out to you. Thanks so much for writing, and I blame myself for making it go poof. Also, I do appreciate your letters and your comments at Lead Stories, L-E-I-D Stories, at gmail.com. It's a way to help me understand what your concerns are, and therefore I try to incorporate these things in the program so that you get the sense I'm paying attention to what it is you're saying. I really believe one of the missions of the Progressive Radio Network and other progressive media outlets is to encourage discussion and debate. We don't do enough of that. To encourage it because we learn from the cross-pollination of ideas. And for too long, we have been very, I think, threatened. We behave as if, you know, there's a club of us, and, you know, just like the politicians behave, that there is this elite club that knows everything, and then everybody else. No, everybody knows something, and everybody has something very important, very valuable to contribute, and should be encouraged to make that contribution. And have it examined and encourage, this exchange of ideas. We certainly can use new ideas. And when we look at the alternatives that we are trying to construct, it's all about new ideas, making new ideas work. But if we have a paucity of new ideas, then we don't have very much of an alternative to present now, do we? So I understand sometimes people are a little shy and, you know, they want to be right. There's no such thing as whether you're right or wrong or whatever. You have an opinion. Be okay with that and content with that. But also train yourselves to think and put the component pieces together, even when everything in your, every fiber of your being says, ah, well, this is as far as I need to go on this idea. Push yourself beyond that limit and see where it takes you. Others would be listening to you, and of course, listening goes at several different levels. When I listen, I listen really, really hard to what is not being said. And I have trained myself to pick that up really quickly. When I look at something, I train myself to see what is not visible. Because we have been stuck in that one dimension of it is what you look at. What you're seeing is exactly what it is, or what you're hearing is exactly what it is. And no, there are a whole ton of different levels of interpretation, and we have to connect with those, because that very often is the more important conversation. What are you thinking? Let's hear it. 1-888-874-4888. So this program is about encouraging the flow back and forth of information. Because sometimes, you know, you say a thing and you think it is, you know, not nearly as important. You don't think it is as important as it really is. And it is, in some cases, real revelation to the person listening. And you may not be prepared for it, but then it hits you. And that's an interesting moment, isn't it? A moment of truth. Pure, unadulterated truth. It comes through. Boom, there it is. Now deal with that. It may make you uncomfortable. It may make you even angry. But it certainly will cause you to rethink your position. Whether you agree or don't agree, just the presentation of a new dimension of an argument, of an issue, or of an event, gets you at a whole different level of interpreting our collective reality. Isn't that what it is? That's what it is. So, in watching Mr. Carey, and, you know, driven almost to tears as he invoked the memory of his dad, who was a career diplomat himself. Carey, it is said, even among his colleagues, is close to realizing a lifelong dream. As much as he has, you know, the benefit of wealth, he's worth close to $200 million. But, you know, it goes in the Congress. The vast majority of people in Congress are quite wealthy. Paul from New York, you're on the air. Thank you for joining us today.
Good afternoon, you two.
Good afternoon.
You've encouraged me to call, so I will call. Thank you for the program. What I'm looking at is public access television. And as it exists in the various cities and states, and New York in particular. And the somehow commandeering of the station, of local access, where you will find the body, the caretaker body, who basically is going to do administration to make sure, handle the monies and allocate for the jobs and things like that, make sure the equipment is taken care of and updated and advertising to get people in to utilize the services. Is that administration now seems to have taken public access and split it in half, where the public no longer really has any access to that other half. And what they're doing is, in my opinion, is pushing their own agendas, whether it be for governmental, industry, corporations. You'll see them underwriting certain things and certain programs. And politicians, actually, it seems to me, have been commandeered, because they can go in there now and get people who on staff, not the locals, the people who public access is designed for and paid for, they have staff who will take care of the politician when they come in, provide them a show, lighting, audio. They know they're going to get a good presentation. So it seems to me they're looking the other way at this, that how can you have a public access station that monies are allocated for it. It's a tremendous amount of monies, in my opinion. And all of a sudden, the public, the producers there are not being encouraged, are somehow getting less space, not having access to certain equipment, certain cameras, certain, you know, that kind of thing, not getting the support system that they would need to propel them further or make sure their shows are getting, because they're in competition with the parent, with the organization that is just supposed to just manage the monies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, because to me, public access is very important. It is the last bastion of what we're supposed to be able to interact with on a certain level, free and relaxed. And when, with the consolidation of the other media, from radio and TV and newspapers and things like that, and actually internet, it seems to me this is the last resort, and it's been happening, again, in my opinion, for decades and a little more now. And
well,
I'm wondering what.
I understand your point here, Paul. I was proud to serve as a member of the board of the Brooklyn Cable Access Television, and from the inside, I appreciated what the battle was, and we had a fight on our hands. Number one, we made it mandatory that this project, which was, you know, it was on the drawing board at the time, must use a black neighborhood bank. It must advertise jobs in black and Latino newspapers. It must adhere to certain standards, and it did, for the time I was there. But what I'm pointing to is the lack, with the same, I mean, the disproportion between the demand for access and the lack of participation in at the board level. That's really what's important, to make these members of the board perform the way they ought to be performing in the public interest. And where that is absent, you find that cable television stations are doing just the flip side of what the corporate media are doing. And it is so in radio, it is so in other forms of media. So I myself, my attention would be to look at the board. Thanks, Paul, for your question. And I'm sure you'll be able to take a look at the board, the components of the board, and see where you can press some buttons and get some action there. Thanks so much for listening. We return to each other on Monday. And in the meantime, have yourselves a good weekend and give yourselves permission to have a good time. Coming up next is the great wake-up call with the even greater Richard Martin. Stay tuned.